Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we're going to answer more of your cycling and triathlon related questions today. You can submit them at trainerroad.com/podcast. Let's get right into questions this time, guys. Let's go with Matt's question. First one. He says, hey guys, love the podcast. Just started Trainer Road a couple weeks ago and I'm loving it. I'm just getting going with the Criterium training plan as I'm hoping that will help with the upcoming race season. I'm just curious how that training plan will affect my FTP. And for those that don't know what FTP is, if you're new to this, functional threshold power. It's roughly equivalent to your lactate threshold in terms of power. Obviously, this is great training for crit racing with the quick intervals and quick rests. Can I expect this to increase my FTP as well? This is my first year of some serious structured training, so definitely room for my FTP to move up.
Matt, when we move into the specialty phase of training, it's much less so than with base and build. We're not so concerned with increases in FTP at that point. It's not to say they won't still happen, but that's not really what we're after specifically. More, we're looking to make you better at whatever it is your race demands. And in this case, with criteriums, it happens to be doing a lot of efforts with not a lot of rest. That in and of itself can affect FTP though. Basically, it's going to force you to operate at a really high oxygen uptake, a really high level of stress, and do so frequently. So which in a lot of cases is enough of a training stimulus to increase capabilities. Whether or not it'll affect your FTP as much as it affects other aspects of your fitness is, it can, but that's not really what we're after. So while you might see some improvements in FTP, I wouldn't concern yourself so much with that as, am I racing better? Am I better to respond to what I need to respond to, if I'm a breakaway rider, can I get away, stay away? If I need to cover things, can I get onto things quickly enough? Those are the concerns that are more prevalent when we work into the specialty phase.
We talk about this a lot, but so if Jonathan and I had the same FTP and say we're the same power to weight, let's say we're both at, let's say five
watts per kilo. Five is fun. If we're pretending, why not, right?
That sounds good. So if we're about the same time, but I am an Ironman athlete and he is a short track mountain bike racer, we could still have the same FTP, but I would smoke him on something long and he would smoke me on something short. So that's what Coach Chad is talking about on this, doing the specialty plans is really like honing your fitness to what kind of event you're going to do. So it might not see a change in FTP, but you should see a change in your short power ability.
Yeah. So for instance, you could take this and see it less as improvements in FTP and more in improvements in performance. So race performance.
Yeah, there's kind of a thing like, you have the weapon, but what can you do with it type of a deal? And depending on the type of scenario you find yourself in, you really want to make sure that it is fine-tuned. And that's something that I've noticed a lot of the time. I'll kind of feel like as I'm progressing through the year, all right, I've kind of crossed that, and threshold is a bad term, so I'll just say I've crossed that benchmark of this is where I need to be in terms of FTP for this season, but now I need to be dynamic with that FTP. I need to be able to respond or to attack or do whatever else I need to do. It really, that's something that I always look for every year to kind of reach that point and then start tuning.
And contrary to that, in addition to that, when I did the cyclocross plan last year, my FTP went up. Mm-hmm. It was just
It's not to say it won't happen, but it's just not the focus.
One thing too, I'm looking at, Matt, you say you just got started and you say that you just started with the Criterium training plan. And for those that don't know, we break your whole season of racing into three sequential phases. So a base phase that's usually around 12 weeks, a build phase that's 8 weeks, and then the specialty phase, that fine tuning stuff we're talking about, is 8 weeks in the end. So seeing as how you just jumped into things, I see this with a lot of people if they just get started with Trainer Road. They'll just jump into, because it makes sense, right? You think I'm a Criterium racer, so I'll pick the Criterium plan. But in a lot of cases, it's better to start a little earlier on, depending on how far away your A race is and everything else, if you can get that training in. But during that build phase, and even toward the latter part of your sweet spot base phase, it's pretty common to see that FTP increase. And the build phase is really where we're focusing a lot on that. But the specialty phase you're in, like we've talked about, that's where this fine tuning happens.
And this might be a good time, Matt, and for everybody to mention, this is why in a lot of the specialty training plans, you won't see a FTP reassessment scheduled on that fifth week. It's always an option, and it's usually mentioned in those week tips. But because, again, we're not chasing FTP increases, it might not be a required workout.
And two, Coach Chad, I'm just called Coach Chad all the time. the workouts are designed to be progressively harder. So even though the FTU doesn't change, still the time at a certain, you either change the duration or the target percentage is higher. So the workouts are getting harder.
Yeah, that's a super good point because honestly, you could go from the first week of a specialty phase all the way through that sixth week before you start to taper. And each week we'll see more demanding workouts. Mm-hmm. So they're still progressive in nature. You're not necessarily seeking FTP improvements, which is why we don't necessarily assess or reassess FTP.
Yeah, we just want to keep your eye on the prize, and that's in fine-tuning things.
I have one more thing to say about this. I think the more room you have to grow and the more beginner you are, the more likely you are to see an FTP improvement during this phase.
Agreed.
Yes.
So if you're a 4 or 5 watt per kilo guy, mm-hmm. you might not get any. But if you're 2, you probably will get an FTP bump.
Yep, that's a real good point.
Yeah, great stuff. Danny, he says, I took my third FTP test of 2017 today and thought my experience would be beneficial to dissect for others to learn from. I'm about to start the half Ironman mid-distance specialty plan. So, and I'm sure he's talking about the mid-volume there. Mid-volume specialty plan. My FTP test went as follows. First 5 minutes, average 268. Second 5 minutes, 266. Third 5 minutes, 245. And then I jumped back up to 260 for the final 5 minutes. I wonder if that big dip was more a mental or physical drop. I swam in college, have done a couple of Ironman races and a bunch of halves, so pacing should not be much of a challenge, and those are his thoughts there. I felt myself dipping in that third 5 minute effort or third 5 minute chunk of my testing interval, and then fought really hard to get back up to the 260s for the final five. I'd love to hear your comments. So I think all of us, well, and maybe this does vary for person to person, but I know the third one is usually the toughest one for me if you're to break it into fourths.
Yeah, anybody, and that's why I actually prescribe pacing in fourths almost always. This is exactly why, because it's that third, fourth segment or that third segment of the four that is the most psychologically demanding. Mm. Your body can still do it. You're just starting to check out because you know, the fatigue is mounting. You're still so far from finishing. You don't have that little incentive or that bit of motivation that comes with the final segment of it. And it doesn't matter if it's a 20-minute segment or an hour-long segment, which in the case of a 40K TT, same thing. I have people approach it in, you know, if they're super fast and maybe they look at 4:13s or 4:14s. In any case, they break that hour down or whatever that duration is into four segments, and it's that third one that gets you every time.
Mm. I want to expand on that point is this is exactly what in that book that Matt Fitzgerald writes, How Bad Do You Want It? For some reason, the fourth section, if you break up any race into four segments, the fourth is easier than the third. Yep. Although physiologically, I can never say that word.
Physiologically, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chad. Coach Chad. it is, that last one is always it. And it's because of that increased motivation. I remember one of the first blog posts I've ever read when I was in triathlon was Joe Friel talking about this very thing. Is that the third, you have to dig the deepest in that third segment. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, I mean, there's no magical thing that once you get to that mm-hmm. third segment, your body acts is harder than later on, you get more, yeah, I'm just making stuff up. It's nothing happening. It's all in your brain. Yeah. It's all in your brain.
So I should tell you right there, I mean, if you can do it physiologically in that fourth segment, then why couldn't you do it in the third? Nothing,
exactly.
Nothing rebounds.
That was the point I was going to bring up is that you have proof that that you actually were capable of doing mm-hmm. more. And something that I always look for in a properly paced effort is an inability to increase it at the end, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm giving absolutely everything and I finish and I'm completely spent, but if I had to have, you know, if you would have asked me to pick it up, if I wasn't able to do that, that was probably a well-paced effort.
I see this a lot in running races. I just went to a local running race in Reno. And you could probably see the last 800 meters or so. And the guys that come in that last 800 and just book it, go so fast, mm-hmm. you know that they did not go as hard as they could. They didn't pace effectively.
Yep.
And then the people that are like, they're barely holding on for those 800, I don't really know their exact pacing, but they at least had something. They didn't leave too much out on the track. The other one is time trials. In the Tour de France, when you see somebody sprinting at the end of an hour-long time trial, like they did not go hard enough. You shouldn't be able to get out and sprint. Yep. And the best guys don't do that who go the fastest. They are still like down and they're dying as they're coming in.
I remember Tony Martin's world championship winning ride. I think I saw him like stop pedaling like two pedal strokes before the line. It was very apparent that the reason that he stopped pedaling was because there was simply nothing left. Like he was consistent, paced it consistently. I remember actually Fabian Cancellara in that same race went out way harder in the beginning, and he had a big lead. And because of that, actually, once Tony was on course, everyone thought, well, Tony's not going to win it because Fabian had such a good first half. But he just stayed super consistent, and when he finished, there was absolutely nothing left. That I think was the time when he had sandpaper on his saddle, and it had worn through his bibs too. Oh, just yeah.
There's
stuff.
Photos of that too, if you're interested.
yeah, if you want to see that.
Expanding on that, this is way in the weeds if you're a time trialist. But the most efficient way to ride a time trial is to, like, end up passing out 2 seconds. It's about 2 seconds before you finish, because if you look at the physics of it, you will carry the inertia for those last 2 seconds across. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard for a human to get this timed right. But if you could physically give nothing more 2 seconds before and you'd carry that over, that'd be faster than giving up nothing more at the finish line. Like, yep. It's just kind of weird. You kind of aim for 2 seconds before going as hard as you can, but you don't want to make that a mental limiter either.
Another proof of this one is if you use a tool like Best Bike Split and you were to see what your ideal time is on a course, it never has you surge at the end.
Yeah, right. It never says.
It always says you continue, right?
Now 1,000 watts.
Right. It never does that.
And when it comes to an FTP test, you don't want that surge either, because all you're doing is artificially inflating a number that we're trying to get basically a good estimate of. You're messing with an estimate. So we're not looking for your peak 20-minute power. We're looking for where you basically normalize or stabilize over that 20 minutes. And a last, 30-second kick where you double your power does nothing to really benefit your training.
Yeah, it's a great point. And like you said, ideally, your peak 20-minute power, what you can maintain for that is, what you stabilize at. But pacing is something that, you mentioned that you've done a couple Ironman races, a bunch of halves, you swam in college. I've done a ton of racing too, and sometimes I still suck at pacing. Like, I know what I should do, but I don't do it. Sometimes it's, pacing can be a really tricky thing, depending on how you're feeling that day, depending on the terrain or whatever other circumstances. It can really take a good game plan and throw you off of it. Pacing is as much about just discipline as it is experience too, because you can have the knowledge and know what you need to do, but if you don't have the discipline to actually follow it, that's tough.
Professionals still mess it up all the time, and they have more experience than all of us combined. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that you can do it 99 times in a row correctly, and it's not like you just do it right every time after that. Yep. The next time, it's a mental battle every single time.
And it's another one of those scenarios that can explain a weaker rider beating a stronger rider, because that weaker rider paced better.
Yeah, good point.
Ooh, guys, when I beat Chad, it's gonna be because of...
Thing is, not to toot my own horn, but I'm super good at pacing, and that's what's actually benefited me in the past. When I don't have the fitness necessary, yet I still make it onto that podium, is because I pace better than guys who are stronger than me.
It's true.
So that's why you beat me?
That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, and look at your FTP test. For everybody that's listening to this, look at your FTP test. If at anything else, just look at it as a great opportunity for you to practice disciplined pacing and accurate pacing. If that's a good opportunity, and that's something, if you have any type of apprehension or anxiety about taking an FTP test, I always find, focusing on one aspect of it that will be beneficial for me, instead of just, because a lot of the time we get so caught up on what the number's going to say about us, and about what we've done. And I always find it beneficial instead just to focus on the fact that, look, like, this is a good opportunity for me to improve a certain aspect of my fitness. So, and pacing is beneficial no matter... We should say this too. It's beneficial no matter what discipline you do, not just time trialing. Mm-hmm. For a cross-country mountain biking, everything else, you have to know how to pace yourself. And that's probably the far extreme, right? Cyclocross, the same thing. You have to be familiar with your limits and know how to pace it. So let's go into Damien's question. Forgive me. He says, "Hey guys, longtime listener, but currently can't afford a subscription to Trainer Road. Quick question. I'm a big bloke at 90 kilograms. I lost 30 kilograms 2 years ago. Nice job, man. That's wow. Awesome. Mm-hmm. And sitting at 350 FTP. Crits are my go, and I scored 3 podiums this season in A grade down in Australia. I'm happy with my season. Anyway, I'm having a crack at the cyclocross series, which kicks off this weekend in Australia. And I'm just wondering if I should stick to my 3-minute intervals or should I go with longer efforts?" Keep in mind, he doesn't use Trainer Road, right? "I can handle lots of TSS as I usually sit around 750 to 900 TSS a week." Sheesh. "And last month's total was 3,400. Great podcast. Love them and have picked up so much from them. 100 stars. Cheers."
So Damien, I'm guessing based on the fact that you can handle that much stress in a week, that your general fitness, all types of general fitness are completely in line. You don't need to focus on anything basic. I would look at the demands of the types of courses you're going to face. And if they involve 3-minute efforts, then keep sticking with those 3-minute efforts. There's a very big steady state nature-ish to cyclocross racing, but it's like criterium racing where it's on, off, on, off. I mean, you can change things up in a crit by breaking away, not as much on a cyclocross course that has obstacles and dismounts and surges where you can't just get into a steady rhythm like you can if you're out in front of a pack of riders. So this is just, you're going to have to get a little bit analytical and see if, maybe when there are 2-minute efforts, you get beat. When there are 4-minute efforts, you don't. And just kind of reason and see, what's going to make the difference and focus on that.
Thinking back to the racing we did in cyclocross this year, I would think, and 3-minute efforts are very, those type of efforts are important, but forgive me. One thing that I can think of too is just the type of like Billat style interval sets. So we're talking about how those look is you're going way above, like maybe even up to like 130-150% FTP, yeah. Maybe.
They're on-off efforts, but the off portions aren't like recovery off. They're more like, 80% squeeze spot sort of
yeah,
off.
Or even right at threshold too sometimes, right there. So you're doing really hard for 15, 30 seconds, then sitting at threshold for 15 or 30 seconds, and you repeat that 6 times or so. And those type of efforts I've found in cyclocross to really help, especially because something that I think we discount a lot of the time is the energy that the run takes out of you, a run up or jumping over something like that, it kind of spikes you up every time once you do it. And then who knows if you have a sand section after that, you have to have a lot of power to go through that and to be able to keep momentum or a short climb. And I've found that if I was to graph my power from the beginning of the race to the end of the race, there would be a bunch of stochastic efforts going up, down, up, down, up, down. But like you said, there is a certain steady state element to it. So it's not just doing a bunch of short off on.
Mainly because you're never resting, not on a cyclocross course. I mean, in a criterium, you can even find rest. You can hide in a field sort of thing. You can get off the front and, maybe there's a downhill stretch or you're resting in the corners or whatever. There's opportunities. Not so much on a cyclocross course.
Yeah, really isn't.
Changing subjects. I think we've answered this question well, but still stay on cross. One thing that I really want to do this year, and I challenge both of you guys. Both of you guys want to race cross again, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because we have national championships coming up this year.
Yeah.
Well, here we should clarify.
Yeah.
They're here in Reno.
Here in Reno.
Which is cool.
And I'll watch them. I don't think I can compete, but.
Why not?
Well, we'll figure that out if I can compete. I'm not going to be in the national, like the elite men's race or anything like that.
No, probably no.
But something that I would challenge all of us to do is to be able to ride over the barriers this year. And I would like us to figure out and get some group practices where we build our own barriers and we figure out what's the best way. Because I think bunny hops, people do do front and rear wheel lifts to get over those.
And some people still run them and find that it's less.
Right. And sometimes in rare situations, but usually it's because of the fact that it's on an uphill. But if it's not on an uphill, it's very rare that running it will be faster. But if it's on an uphill and they have barriers, which they're wont to do here locally, I don't know how it'll be for national championships, but that can be pretty tough if it's an uphill because you bunny hop, lose momentum, lose all momentum, and then you have another barrier or something like that.
Do you ever see, I know we don't typically, or we haven't yet, do we ever see more than 2 barriers in a row, like 3 or 4 or 5?
Really rare, really rare.
But what I want though is just to have that in an arrow in our quiver. So we don't have to do it every time, but I want us to all be capable of it and to do it in a race. Each one of us, even if it's not the best thing, just to do it, maybe get on video.
Yeah.
Because it just looks cool.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think we can all do it and we'll have to practice it. Maybe we do an Instagram of us practicing. It'll be funny.
I built some PVC.
Funny for me.
PVC obstacles that if you hit them, they just fall down. So it's not quite a messy crash.
Great way to do it.
Depending how you go over them though. If you do front wheel lift, I think you actually put the wheel on the obstacle. So you want it to be wood. I was thinking we have those, we bought these Wave Rider.
Is that the brand Wave Rider?
I think I don't know. They're like these skateboard ramps that people use for mountain biking. And we bought them right when I broke my collarbone. So we haven't taken them out yet, but, I think it's the right height to at least practice part of it. Like the front wheel lift, getting your, like going up to it, get your front wheel up, get on there and then get off the other end.
Here's some fun. I'm sorry, Nate, for interrupting there. Something interesting on this is so the set that we got, it has ramps, but mm-hmm. then it also has blocks mm-hmm. that are the same height as those ramps. So you can basically ride up on top of something and then drop off, or you can go the other route and you can bunny hop up onto that and ride it for a bit, then bunny hop off. And I think that that's something that's really beneficial, is just to learn to get up to that height first and then to worry about clearing the actual barrier completely with distance, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful. And this is cross focus, so hopefully this is helpful, but the one thing that about front wheel lifts and rear wheel lifts, it's really tricky to do a lot of the time in cyclocross, just because you have such a small, you're erasing your margin of error to such a knife's edge, right? If you drop that front wheel down a little too early, you go over the bars yeah. and you make yourself a YouTube sensation. If you drop it just a little too late, then what happens is that you hit it with your bottom bracket and your crankset and you go down. So it's a really tricky thing to time. That said, I don't know if you guys have noticed this or ever when you're riding, our body is incredibly capable at timing that. Now, when we're hypoxic, that's a different story.
Hi, I'm Nate Pearson. Have you met me before? Yeah. My body is incredible at timing what?
Yeah. But I guess that the reason I bring that up is because there's a lot of times when I have to go over a rock or something when I'm mountain biking and it's tall. And I'll go over something and think, man, I did not just mean to do it like that, but it worked out perfectly.
So you're saying the best mountain bike handler on this podcast and known for his skills is saying, yeah, it just flows naturally, right?
No, it's a lot of work, right? At that point, I guess it does. But anyways, getting back to the root of it, yeah, if we had that in our quiver, plus the good gearing we have, plus the dropper post will really help with yeah. this. But with those type of things, I think that we're really enabled. If we can have that skill too, it really does help. We've gone over that before, and I know a lot of people kind of frown on that with dropper posts and changing up your gearing to be really low. But putting on those gears helped out a number of times this year in a cross race. We didn't have to run, and we could stay on our bikes, save more energy, and go faster.
I mean, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
Tradition be damned.
Yep.
To add on to those ramps, I think they're called Wave Rider. I'm sorry if they're not, but the reason we bought them was to practice mountain bike skills mm-hmm. because you can do so many things on them. So the one thing that I haven't used them yet because of my collarbone, but the one thing I do have to say is they take up a lot of space. So if you want to mm-hmm. get them, make sure you have somewhere to store them. They just stack. So there's not a, I mean, you better have room in your garage. It's a lot of space.
Yep. Yeah. And if you have kids, I'm sure they'll be really happy.
Oh yeah. My kids can't wait. Yeah. Like they can just ride up, and I'm going to have them do it pretty soon. I bought my daughter actually a Rip Rock, which is a specialized,
yeah.
It's a mountain bike that has fat bike tires, 2.8 inches, and it's 20-inch wheels.
It's like disc brakes too, I think.
Disc brakes and a front shock.
Wow.
And it's too big for her right now, but she can ride it and she's excited. And I wanted her to be able to brake with her hands. Mm-hmm. And I wanted her to be able to ride a mountain bike with me. So I'm going to have her go up this ramp, just up a ramp and down a ramp, something real nice and easy to get started in mountain biking.
She'll love it. Michael's question. He says, okay, I think I've got a question here you haven't addressed on any of the podcasts. Yes, I've listened to them all. Good job, Michael. That's a different type of muscular endurance right there. He says, this is the first winter since moving to Utah that I've actually built up any fitness, and I feel so ready for the season now. Thank you. However, I had some issues that I'm starting to think are trainer turbo specific, as I've never experienced these things before. When starting out a few months ago, I had the hardest time with butt pain. Never had to deal with saddle discomfort to that degree before. I even got saddle sores, but worked through it and sorted that out soon enough. Then came the sore neck, worked through it. Now out of nowhere, my right Achilles tendon is acting up. It doesn't hurt, but about 15 minutes or so into a workout, I start to notice it. It doesn't hurt, just feels a little tight. I've never had any issues ever with my Achilles tendon before this, and I haven't changed anything except the pedals to Garmin Vectors. But the key thing here, he says, the shoes and the cleats are the same. I moved the cleat back a little and lowered my saddle a hair, stayed off the bike for a week, then went on a 40-mile ride outside yesterday, and I felt great. I felt strong, even got a few PRs. Then today I came in ready to get back on the back on trainer road, and 15 minutes in, I started to feel the Achilles tendon tighten. Again, no pain, but I can't help but feel I shouldn't push it. I also have to think this might be another trainer thing. I wouldn't know. This is the first season I've used the trainer consistently. So he says, so after that, could it be that the trainer stresses the body in different ways from riding outside that can cause physical ailments? I just find it funny I've had to deal with physical issues I've never experienced in decades of cycling. So this is, so I've actually had these thoughts before, and Nate, you were key in kind of helping me go through a lot of these.
I was?
Yeah, you were. You may not even know, but you're a very, I guess, analytical and pragmatic person when like people think, because it's easy, I ride the trainer and I have pain, right? And that's what I assumed. There was like, there must be something with riding the trainer.
Obsessive compulsive, you can say it.
Yes, yeah, okay. You are, yeah. But I've actually found this not to be the case for myself, that the trainer specifically causes anything. But Chad, have you ever noticed anything?
Well,
like
let's look at one fundamental thing before we even get to all his ailments, is that he's training more than he's ever trained before. Whether it's on the trainer or outdoors, he's doing more work than he's ever done, and he's facing issues as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, so that's all this boils down to. But we can kind of pick this apart a little bit. In the case of saddle sores or a sore butt on the trainer. And it goes indoors or outdoors, when you're doing low load work. So if you're doing easy stuff where you're at 60% for long durations, sometimes multiple hours, that's just part and parcel. It just goes with it, unfortunately. I mean, you can tweak your bike, you can blame your saddle, you can say it's a bike fit issue, but the fact is your body just isn't used to being in that same position and bearing so much of the load on your sit bones rather than legs, muscles that are actually driving the bike a little more forcefully.
Wait, can you explain that a little more?
You're
touching on the point that when you put out less wattage, it hurts on your butt.
Yeah.
So what would happen if I had an FTP of, let's say, 380 versus 180 mm-hmm. for my butt? Describe my butt.
I'd rather not. What I'm getting at is that if you're working at a low percentage of your threshold, your leg muscles, your feet aren't bearing as much of the load. So you're more squarely positioned on the saddle, and there's simply more weight on your butt. I mean, and you notice a difference when you work at 50% as opposed to when you're drilling it at 120%. I mean, there's barely any weight on your saddle in that case. And then when you do longer stuff, threshold stuff, sweet spot stuff, it's a really nice distribution of weight on all those contact points.
Could it be that, so the more watts I'm putting out, the more kind of up I'm pushing up with my body, so there's less pressure on
relative to your own threshold. Mm-hmm. So regardless of a 180 threshold versus a 380 threshold, it's really about how much power you're putting out relative to your own threshold.
Why does that have to matter?
Just probably in weight, I guess, is what I would think probably factors into this. Because really, I know my wife, when she first started out, and she wasn't, she didn't have a high FTP or anything else like that. The saddle always hurt her. And as she got stronger,
are you going to talk about your wife's weight?
No, we're not talking about that. Weight, and then when I went to wife, we dropped that, okay?
Okay.
yeah. Clear separation, let's be clear. But it was really hard for her. She was really uncomfortable. She started getting stronger, and she started having less saddle pain. Now, part of that also, she was still putting out a decent amount of time outside on the bike, but it wasn't, I guess my point with all of this is the fact that as she was able to lift or put out more force into those pedals and push her body a little more off of that saddle, mm-hmm. she had less pressure.
That's all I'm talking about. Yeah. So
that's what I'm saying too. But I also think that if my FTP was 400 versus 200, at 400, I would have less pressure on the saddle.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
that stands to reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chad.
I just wanted to pick through these. So unless we have anything else to say on this, I was going to move on to neck pain.
Yeah, let me cover that one actually really quick. So I've noticed a lot of people, and this is with the butt pain stuff again, I've noticed a lot of people recognize, even if they have, let's say they're riding at a high intensity, they might notice more discomfort on their saddle when they're on the trainer. There's a couple of reasons that are compound together for that. Number one, your bike is usually on a trainer static, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't move freely like it does outside. Some people like Chad, for example, Chad has a very quiet pedaling technique and quiet in terms of his body movement. There isn't a lot of lateral movement, not a lot of twisting going on, but a lot of people, especially once things get hard in terms of like the effort is increasing, you get a lot more body movement and you become less disciplined about keeping your body stably anchored with those seat bones, and you start to thrash around a bit, move around a bit more. And that will definitely make your saddle more uncomfortable. And that will also cause the cascade of issues that you potentially mentioned there also with not possibly the neck pain. We'll get to that in a bit, but the Achilles tendon stuff, if you're twisting around and torquing around and your foot's anchored into that pedal, and who knows what type of float you have going on with your cleats and everything else like that. But if that's suddenly a pivot point, having to take a lot of stress because your bike is fixed and you're not, fixed on your bike, that could cause an issue like that. One quick thing on Achilles tendon stuff too. A lot of the time I think people they look at their Achilles tendon, look up from that into your posterior chain, but also look at your feet. A lot of massage therapists and PT and everything else, if you have Achilles tendon pain, they'll try to release everything around your foot and your heel and try to get that to relax. And that's always helped me if I've ever had issues with that. But
yeah, Michael, as far as your Achilles goes, that just sounds like a pretty typical overuse injury. So your body was used to not a lot of this sort of effort, and now you're doing a whole lot of it, and it's just been too rapid a transition, and this connective tissue doesn't adapt as quickly as muscle tissue does. It simply doesn't. It doesn't get the same amount of blood flow or nutrients. So you just have to be a little more careful in terms of conditioning that type of tissue.
So what about the neck though, Chad? You're going to talk about
the neck. I think that's just a product of riding a lot too. I mean, it's the same thing. If you spend, you know, 1 hour trainer sessions versus, you know, heading outside for 40 miles, which I'm guessing is going to take you anywhere from 2 to 2.5 hours, it's just more time in that position. And if you've been indoors and you're maybe not focusing on where you would focus when you're outdoors, there's a real tendency to, you know, angle your head down. Or if you're watching a tablet or a phone or something, your head's down looking at that, not looking at where the road would be. You're simply not accustomed to that type of stress. And you head outdoors and you got to keep your eyes up and you got to see what's coming at you. It's just a mildly different position, but it's different enough. And you're holding it for a long period of time. And as you get tired, people tend to bunch up in between their, you know, shoulder blades and around the spine, and neck pain just comes along with that.
I read this actually that he had neck pain inside when he hadn't experienced it outside. And what I see by pictures of people's trainer setups is they put a TV mounted kind of like where they might watch, like above their fireplace or something, which is a bad place anyways. Don't mount your TV above your fireplace because you're looking up the whole time. And they like, and their head is way higher than it would be outside. So it's like your same point, except opposite.
Yeah, that's a good catch. And that's exactly, I mean, if you look at my little pain cave in my basement, the TV is basically at hip level so that I only have to cock my head up just enough. Again, where my eyes would be, you know, right on the horizon, basically.
That's the key, is make sure it's the same as that it would be outside.
Something also that a lot of people don't realize, this is something that from my motocross days that was big when I would be working with people and training them. A lot of people think that they need to move their head up, and I'm rotating my head upward, right? When in order to look ahead. But a lot of the time what that does is that puts a weird, awkward bend in our back. It puts a lot of stress into there. And if you look at a lot of top riders when they're racing, don't look at Marcel Kittel because he's strangely different in this case. It almost looks like somebody is like placed a head in front of him that's always looking perfectly forward. But in most cases, you'll see a lot of athletes and they're fantastic at looking ahead. Their head is not angled perfectly flat, looking straight ahead, parallel to the ground. Their head's angled down, but their eyes are looking up.
Yeah,
and there's a difference there.
I'll say that in the workout text a lot too, is tip your head down, tip your eyes up.
Yeah.
That being the idea.
That's huge for triathletes, is you can't be in a good arrow position if your head up all the way. So your head's down, but then your eyes rolled up and it's kind of uncomfortable. Then they get we've talked about the last time, but the glasses without rims and that kind of thing so they can see through, or a visor.
And you'll notice, I mean, some riders will cock their head off to one side. I mean, a lot of us don't have perfectly level eyes. You know, we've got the dominant eyes typically a little higher, and you'll roll that side so that that eye is just a little bit higher than the other, and you'll see that head cocked position. I mean, some people just get it when they start working real hard, but other people just get it because if they want to keep their head down and their eye line up, it kind of defers to the dominant eye.
Vroom must have really unlevel eyes.
I was just going to say that.
That's what made me think. He just cocks his head.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. So, Michael, we're kindred spirits in the sense that we're both delicate flowers. We aren't these really robust athletes that tend to never have any connective tissue issues. I do, just like you. But what I've found is that that me riding the trainer actually has not been the cause. All it's done is highlighted different areas for improvement outside of that. So in the way, the trainer was a good thing for me because then I realized, oh, I need to refine my pedaling technique, or I need to refine my fit or something like that. So hopefully this is just a look at it as a great concentrated, distilled way for you to refine things further, Michael, and hopefully you take care of that Achilles. Don't let it go too far. Warwick. Hi team, love the podcast. As a result of listening to most of the back catalog, I've recently resubscribed to Trainer Road and I'm motivated to get into training with a lot more structure this offseason in New Zealand.
Yes!
Sweet. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back, man. Good to have you. He says, my question relates to choosing a low or a mid-volume plan. My work hours, and this is a really good question, actually. I've had something similar to this before. He says, my work hours are fairly flexible, so I can probably get on the trainer enough for a mid-volume plan. But sometimes life, kids, etc., takes up more time as well as creates more fatigue. And I might only be able to do 3 sessions a week. Am I better to start on a mid-volume sweet spot bass and not worry too much in the weeks I miss one or two sessions? Or should I start on a low volume plan and add in some extra zone 2 or endurance on the weeks I can get in more sessions than the low volume prescribes? Here's some info about him. He says, I've ridden it for a number of years and I'm fairly confident I can handle the TSS of mid volume, but I've never really trained with proper structure before. I'm wanting to target a 115-mile, very hilly road race in October and try and set a personal best, which I set before children when I was riding a lot more outdoors. We're always chasing that ghost, right, from the past there. My main concern is that low volume might not be enough to do this. Thanks in advance for your advice.
So we almost always, and maybe I could say always, prescribe starting with the lower volume plan before considering the higher volume plan, just to see, you know, especially if you're new to structured training, just to see how your body responds. And it's better to, you know, move upward than to go backward. Certainly better to underdo it than to overdo it when you're new to this sort of stuff and just in general. And then I really like the idea of what you suggested. You do a couple hard workouts and then you supplement with some endurance work. That's pretty much what I prescribe if you had asked me this question directly. Mm-hmm. So start with that lower volume plan. The mid-volume plan is not going to be a big jump in any other respect than that, really. So the workouts might get a little longer. The intense workouts might get slightly longer, but really you just start to see more of the type, the zone 2-3 stuff that you're mentioning anyway.
Something that I'm thinking about with this too is that the training plans trend intentionally, and you know the workouts will, like Nate, you mentioned earlier when we were talking a little bit, but you know, you might spend more time at a specific intensity, or that rest might shrink, and that progresses steadily as time goes on. So if you do go with a mid-volume plan, if you're in between like this and you go with a mid-volume plan and you skip workouts every once in a while, it might make it tougher because you might go back the next week and you've skipped that week of progression perhaps, you know? So the low volume plan, that's another, I guess, just another vote for the low volume plan and adding it in where you can.
Well, and you, work, you also mentioned that you feel confident that you can handle the TSS, but I'm don't be overly confident. Make sure you can handle this type of TSS, because we were talking about last week, I did some long outdoor rides and in total, I rode about 6 hours and I accumulated, I don't even think I cracked a total of 350 TSS over that 6 hours.
Wow.
To get that 350 TSS indoors, I could do that in 3 tough 1-hour rides, you know, roughly thereabouts. So the fact is you can get it. You may think you can handle the TSS, but not all TSS is created equal.
If I were you, Warwick, I would go into the low volume, hit each plan as hard as, or each workout as hard as I could, and they would just be awesome workouts. If I got through 2 weeks, didn't miss a single workout, I'd then add maybe Pettit somewhere in there, or Fletcher, or Baxter. Mm-hmm. And then if I was still consistent and life didn't get in the way, that's a big thing, is life not getting in the way, then maybe after those, the first time you went through a whole plan, then try the mid-volume. Mm. But it's so much easier to go up than it is to go down. Mm-hmm. And as you go up, you keep getting, we talked about this, like I swear, 2 podcasts ago, you keep getting better and better.
Yeah.
But when you get too much, you just have to take rest weeks and recover, and then you get in a hole and it's not happy for anything.
I can think of a lot of athletes that do a lot of work occasionally and not a lot of work at other times. And I can think of other athletes just do a middle line or even lower amount of work, but they are just deadly consistent with it. They're faster usually. That's just how it works. I think consistency, Nate, you kind of hammered down on making sure you can hit your 3 workouts a week with that low volume plan. If you're consistent with that, then that's awesome. It's not only is it mentally encouraging, but also it's very physically enabling when you're just consistent with it over time. And you'll wear guys down that are trying to do too much and then, you know, falling back.
I harp on this all the time, but I have not been consistent in the past for a whole bunch of reasons, a whole bunch of excuses. But when I am consistent, my FTP goes up. When I'm not consistent, my FTP goes down. And even when I did like 2 weeks of the high volume plan, I did 2 weeks of it and then I fell off the rails, right? Because I thought, hey, I can make the time I was doing the opposite of what I tell everybody to do. I had the time to do it and I thought my body could take the stress. So instead of doing more of a mid volume and then moving up, I just went right into high, and 2 weeks it happened and then it was down, down, down.
Yeah. And it's a bummer. It's not something you bounce right back from usually. It takes a toll. I mean, it can take a couple weeks to come back from something like that. And that's 2 weeks of mediocre or poor training following that great big overload where you think you're going to emerge this bigger, better athlete. And the fact is you're facing a setback.
And I think you guys have all heard me complain about my tired legs during that time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a symptom of doing too much too much stress. My body just couldn't recover from it. Mm-hmm. And again, I have so many excuses. We don't need to go through them right now, but I think I would be a stronger athlete today if I would have just done mid-volume and not even touched the high volume because of my lifestyle and genetics.
I agree completely.
Excuses.
One thing too, I just want to hit home and really back up what Chad said on just because you've done stress like this before, you mentioned that this is kind of your first foray into this type of structure and it really does change the game. That's when it's really not about how much time you have, it's about how much stress you can take. So it changes the game.
I want to train now. I always know it's a good podcast. We're in the middle of it. I like just want to leave the room and get on my bike.
Nice. Hopefully other people feel that too, right?
Yeah, they just turn the podcast off.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Sam says, first, thank you for the great podcast and product. When you're ready to sell me some TR swag, I'll proudly rep the brand. We get a lot of requests for that. We definitely do. Who knows? It's someday we may figure it out there. Tonight is my first 3-4, and he's talking category 3-4 criterium, after upgrading to a 4 last year. Congrats on your 4 upgrade, by the way. Probably one of the hardest ones, depending on where you live, to get. Like in our area, for example, getting your Cat 4 upgrade usually requires probably around $1,200 in expenses and then like constant traveling.
Travel.
Because you have to do now with, if anybody doesn't know, with USA Cycling, there are no exemptions. You have to do 10 races. You can finish dead last. You can finish first. It doesn't matter. You just have to do 10 races.
And for us, it's 40 to 50 hours of driving.
Yeah.
To get that.
It sucks. Man,
that is real.
It's a ton of work. So, Sam, you've climbed Everest with that. Good job. He says, I haven't raced at the threes before. My goal is to finish with the pack. So my question is, after this race and others, I have a power file on my Garmin that I pull time and TSS from, but that's it. How else can I use the power data to tweak my training? Am I missing out on potential improvements by not taking a closer look, especially after races? Thank you. This is funny. He says, P.S. I always picture Nate as Frankie Andreu.
Thank you.
You actually do bear a resemblance. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Extremely handsome.
And fast on the bike, right? Yeah. And Chad as the guy from the Farmers Insurance commercials.
That's J.K. Simmons, and he is one of my favorite actors. So thanks also.
Awesome. Despite knowing full well what you actually look like. So what to pull from Criterium Racing specifically in this case from a power file?
Yeah. So if you're finishing with the pack, the classic thing that people look for in criteriums are how many matches you have. Mm-hmm. So how many times can you go to, let's say, how many times your 1 minute power can hit 400 watts, right? So you could look at your power and say, how many of those do I have? And I can do it 6 times, but to really finish the race, I needed to do it 8 times. Mm-hmm. So then you could look inside of Trainer Road. You could either build your workout like that. This is advanced stuff. You could build a workout that says, I'm going to have that power output with rest and I'm going to do it 8 times. And you're going to get your body better at that. And you could train specifically for what's your limiter in that crit. Mm-hmm. I would argue, though, that the specialty training plan for Criterium that's in Trainer Road is probably going to do that exact thing because mm-hmm. it's the same energy systems. There's a lot of work doing that stuff. And crit racing, like it's the same kind of energy systems over and over and over again, unless you're on a really, really weird course. But still, it's almost always the same kind of energy systems. It's not your 120-minute steady-state power, right?
Right.
It's these 30-second, 1 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes kind of power, and these on-off stuff that we just talked about in an earlier question. So you could do that and pull it out. But I think what I do is I just pull the TSS. What about you guys?
Yeah, I would just... It's tough because so many courses aren't the same. So you can't even say on this course, I need to be strong with 1 minute efforts. On this course, I need to be able to hit 2 minute efforts. But you can kind of determine, you know, first what matches are for you. You know, are they, you know, 30 seconds at this power output, but when I go to 1 minute, then their power output drops sharply. Is that a concern? I mean, there's a lot that can be gleaned from this, but you do have to be willing to, you know, get lost in the weeds on it. And, you know, whether or not that benefits your racing performance, kind of, it's iffy.
I have a few specific things that I look for from my power profiles. From a mountain bike race, but especially from a criterium, I look for this. If I am in a breakaway, or if I try to break away, I should clarify that not every attempt actually makes me in a breakaway, but when I try that, I look at where I'm, after I put in that hard effort, I look to where I can settle in And that's just more of like a, okay, so, you know, because I see like early season, a lot of the time, those hard efforts, and especially after more and more hard efforts, it'll get really difficult for me to actually maintain close to threshold or anything else like that. So I just look at that as a little indicator of, okay, yeah, I'm on track or I'm going in the right place. Once again, it's just to back up what my training should already be taken care of. So that's one thing that I look for. And the other thing, and this one's super tricky, and I have, we're talking like a salt lick, like a horse's salt lick size, a grain of salt to the side on this one. But I look at my, if I'm wearing a heart rate monitor, which I haven't been doing lately, and I'm not missing it, by the way. So I'm not missing not having my heart rate monitor, but sometimes I'll look at where my, or how quickly my, I was able to, or my heart rate dropped down to a certain amount or a certain percentage compared to a previous time. That is tricky because of all the reasons heart rate is tricky, which we've talked about plenty of times. It's a variable metric. It's highly subjective. Plenty of factors influence it. But that's another thing that I might look for in off-on stuff to see how quick things are going. But once again, I've had plenty of times where I've looked at that data and I've been like, ooh, my heart rate wasn't recovering well, but I still won the race and I still had a power PR. So it's just, it's always kind of tricky.
It doesn't, for me, that wouldn't really change anything.
It wouldn't.
Well, see, and that's what I wanted to, I wish I'd prefaced that in my comment, Sam, with you're a Cat 4 who's, or you're just now a Cat 4 and you're racing with the Cat 3s. I don't think you need to worry about any of this just yet. I think getting lost in the weeds, as I put it, is not really going to be of the same benefit to you now that it will be when you, you know, maybe move into the 3s. Or into the 2s eventually, if you mm-hmm. take it that far. The fact is that there are bigger fish to fry right now, and breaking down your files and trying to, you know, count matches and figure out these finer details, I just think that's a little ahead of schedule.
I completely agree with you. Mm-hmm. But another fun thing to look at is your peak power in sprinting. When I used to sprint in crits, I don't do anymore because it's like so dangerous. And yeah. But when I did do it, it's always fun to look at your peak power, right?
And it was.
Absolutely.
What was yours, Nate?
So I didn't have a high peak, but I could hold long. So I think my peak ever was like 13:46.
Nice.
But then I could hold like 980 for I think 20 or 30 seconds.
Yeah, he has crazy long duration at that. At
yeah,
that high power.
That is.
That's what I said. I've been saying I'm a high anaerobic work capacity
no,
guy.
I never argued it.
Yeah.
What about you, Chad? What's your peak?
I've had a peak jump at 1816, so a little over 18 watts. But then
1800 watts.
I'm sorry. No, I.
Chad's winning Strider races over here.
I decline not precipitously, but compared to Nate, precipitously. So I mean, if we went like a drag strip sort of sprint, Nate would beat me. But if I time my sprint, although now that I've said that, we can try it. I'm game.
I haven't done any efforts like that for a long time.
Yeah, so, no, me neither. We could throw together a little 4-week challenge. Or something. I don't know. I'll let you deal with that.
It has to be in a real. I don't want to like make up a race for me to beat you in. Like, you know what I mean? Like, okay, this is the exact situation.
Yeah.
It's just got to be a regular race that we do, and it happens.
I think my highest is I've hit 1400, and I want to say it was like 1401, 1402, right there. And this weekend, actually, I did a long mountain bike ride. I needed to dial in my new bike that I got, so I was out there spending a lot of time getting it sorted, and I was like 3 hours into the ride, and then I did a really hard effort, but it was on a hard pack road with some gravel on top, and I hit 1300. I was impressed with that because it's hard to hit high wattage numbers when you're on variable surfaces like that because you lose traction. So you're constantly fighting to hold that. So
that is impressive.
I was, yeah, I was impressed with that. That's good. So.
I think I know, changing subjects. Are we done with this question?
Yeah.
Okay, changing subjects. My best chance is...
best chance of beating Chad?
Yep, cyclocross. That could be my best chance because there's a little bit of skill involved. So if Chad makes a few skill mistakes, I could beat you in that.
Yeah,
and
it's true. I just think you should aim higher. I mean,
well, it's baby
I'm real
steps.
Good. I get that, but
it's baby steps, Chad.
I think personally, I think that would be a really tough one for you to beat because Chad, although he doesn't talk about it much or give himself credit for it, he's a heck of a not only a normal like you know road bike handler, but you started in mountain biking, you spent a lot of time mountain biking, and you're very comfortable on two wheels, which that's almost like, I look like all the juniors that race mountain bikes with us. Mm. It's like you can't have, like, if you're addressing a group, there are like three kids bouncing on a rear wheel and another kid standing on top of his seat. Like, it's just like a circus at all times, right?
I think about that when I see older riders and they crash a lot and I know they don't have a background. And by background, I mean, they didn't start riding at a young age because those riders who did, they have such an advantage.
They do. And I think that they would be really good at cyclocross racing because you're going through so many slow, balancey, technical things like that. Mm-hmm. And you're on a bike that is less able, technically speaking, than a mountain bike or anything else like that on terrain that might push it out of its realm. So that's when you really need the skill to be able to overcome the deficiency of the bike.
And you get the benefit of learning at a younger age when your body's a little more forgiving and a little lower to the ground. Because I think of the times, I mean, I was real good at jumping, but I was terrible at landing. I mean, I did so many crashes, but you know, I figured it out. But I figured it out a really tough way, not something you can do as a 30-year-old.
Right, right, yeah.
Are you guys telling me I have no chance?
No, I think you could. I just think that the one arrow, so your weakness is technical bike handling, right?
But I can practice, so.
But you can practice and improve it.
I think your road is a little longer than it would be for a kid who's been riding since 5 years of age.
Oh, yeah. So I'm thinking that the chances, mountain bike, but I'm so bad at handling and stuff. He's going to beat me in mountain biking. But in cross, I think my the fear level and the amount of practice that I can do, and it's not as technical as mountain biking, that would be my best shot. I can't wait for the day that we start the podcast. Let's all just think about it.
Well, in some days or sometimes cyclocross is more technical, but it's almost always slower. And that's one thing that's kind of a fear point for you is speed, right, Nate? And Chad, I've seen you're comfortable with speed. Mm-hmm. So that absolutely makes sense. Because mountain biking, balance and technique aside, the speed factor is a big limiter.
Oh, for sure. So. If I go 8 miles per hour, I'm like not afraid.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like I can run faster than that.
I'll tell you what, I'm never going I'm never going to throw a race, but I will derive a certain level of satisfaction if Nate beats me. It's not going to be the worst day.
And I won't count it if you're sick
I'm not going to give you any breaks.
A flat tire. I want you to go all out, but I think I'm going to upgrade to three. I should. I hope I can upgrade to three because I'm a district champion.
Yeah, you can.
I beat two guys. Yeah. And one of them was a junior. I think then we'll be in the same B's and we'll start the same.
Cool.
But I might actually, I might start ahead of you. Darn it. It wouldn't be a fair race.
Because of age?
Yeah. I think they might send off.
I don't have to do masters.
Real old. So we'll see.
Okay, now I'm looking forward to beating him.
All right, let's go. Yeah, now you're going to relish in it. So question from Daniel. He says, hey, team, love the podcast. I'm working through the back catalog right now and learning a lot. Good company on the long runs and 5 stars. He mentions that he's actually given us 5 stars and it's not a hollow promise. That's good. Good to hear. He says, I'm getting ready for Ironman Australia in a couple weeks, and which actually I think is maybe this coming weekend. It's coming up. Or maybe it already happened. I can't keep track of all the Ironman events. They're going on all the time. He says, and I've got a pretty discreet gear question that I've always been curious about, but can never find any real data on. And just to be clear, we don't have any real data on your situation. I did some research, but we don't have a wind tunnel. So we weren't able to get really into this. But the question relates to shoes and aerodynamics. Yeah. Like many triathletes, I have a dedicated pair of triathlon bike shoes that are easy to slip in and out of for a flying mount and dismount. But I'm questioning at what distance the time saved in transition is outstripped by the aero benefits of a more sleek pair of shoes. And just to cover this really quick, for anybody that doesn't know what a triathlon shoe looks like, Nate, can you describe what it looks like and how it's different than like a normal road shoe, a typical tri shoe? They vary, but...
Yeah, it just has like a big wide opening with one kind of flap that goes over. Sometimes it can be Velcro, sometimes it won't be... The S-Works triathlon one actually has something where the heel opens in the back. So you can have a magnet strap your heel open and you slide your shoe in and then you can tighten it down right there.
And triathletes usually keep their shoes clipped in to their bikes in transition. So then when they get out of the water, they just grab their bike, they run, they jump on, and then they put their feet on top of their pedals and pedal for a while until they get some momentum going. And then they'll put one foot in, pedal, then put the other one in. That way it's just quicker than sitting down, putting your shoes on, then getting on. And also running in cleats isn't exactly the best or safest thing to do. So that's the lowdown on triathlon shoes for anybody that doesn't know. My tri shoes are Bonts, which are very comfortable but quite bulky with a large strap. My road shoes are S-Works road shoes, which look like they have a much more subdued aero profile with one small strap each and two BOA dials. And that small strap is, if anybody doesn't know, is down at the toes. It's pretty out of the way. I appreciate that there is probably not any hard data on these particular shoes, but do you have any indication on how much time would be saved in 180 kilometers with the road shoes? I can do the flying dismount in the road shoes. I just can't practically get them on while moving. How about aero shoe covers? And this one, this one's really tricky, but he says they would add in even more time in transition, but would that time be gained back by aero savings across the approximate 5 hours and 40 minutes I'm planning on spending on the bike? Appreciate your thoughts on what the best way to go here is, and curious to hear how you would approach it. So let's cover this really quick.
I have strong feelings about this.
Do you want me to share the data first, Nate, or do you want to go over your...
Let's go over the details first, and you can talk about those.
Okay, so we don't have much data on, you know, we don't have any data on Bonts versus the S-Works shoes that you have. I also don't know if you have previous generation S-Works shoes, so from 2015 or before, or the 2016 or above ones. So those are the new S-Works 6 and the Sub 6. Sub 6 are the laces ones. You mentioned that you have ones with dials, so I assume you don't have the laces ones. That said, just to give you an idea of what you could be leaving on the table, the S-Works lace shoes, so the Sub 6 ones, versus the standard BOA dial ones from the previous generation, those would save you 2 minutes and 45 seconds over 180 kilometers. So it's not a whole lot over 180 kilometers.
Let's talk about those first. You would not be able to use those in a triathlon because...
How would you lace them up?
Well, right? No. You have to lace them up, and then you have to put the cover over and smooth it out. And that takes me like 5 minutes right there. Yep. But then when you get off, you'd have to take off the cover and unlace them.
You're looking at more than 2 minutes and 45 seconds and just putting things on or off for sure.
For the laces, yeah.
I would think.
So I have some real data and then anecdotal stuff. I'll start with the real data. Jordan Rapp, which is a triathlete who was sponsored by Specialized, he was in their wind tunnel, and he chose to use the BOA dial road shoes over their S-Works Trivent, which I'm guessing is like the Bonds that had the big thing over the top, because the amount of time that it took him to put those shoes on was less than the amount of time that he was losing compared to the Trivents, because those are very not aerodynamic.
Yeah, something to add to this too is the shape of the shoe, usually road shoes provide like more tension or more support, something like that as well. So that's something to factor in, right? Like you may have more efficient power transfer, not just aerodynamics with a road shoe than you might have with a tri shoe.
And the tri shoes too always have these holes in them, which I think is the biggest marketing thing, unless you do one thing. Mm-hmm. But like they say like, oh, it's so the water comes out. But by the time that you get out of the bike and you get out of the water and get onto your bike, you're not wet. Like there's not going to be a cup of water. The only difference is if you go to the bathroom on your bike, then that could be beneficial to have holes in your shoes.
Yeah.
So right there, I think that's a good data point that Jordan Rapp uses that. Now anecdotal stuff. When we caught bikes at Kona, the very first age grouper coming in had aero shoe covers on his feet. Mm-hmm. And remember, he smoked everybody, but that doesn't mean it's because of the aero shoe covers. Mm-hmm. He came in and he stopped. I saw him. He unzipped them and took them off both feet. And they were obviously aero shoe covers and not for warmth because it's Kona. Mm-hmm. And he ran in and he looked great. That doesn't mean that it's faster either, because he could have just had a 430 watt FTP or something and just blew everybody away. The one thing that people do to the run. So in my experience, I have passed people, like I'll put my cleats on in transition, run out on my cleats, click, 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 and then I jump on, and I have passed so many people who have gotten out with me, mm-hmm. and they're trying to put their feet into the pedals to get going. Mm-hmm. On the opposite side, I have also done it where I come out with some of the water, I grab my bike, and I look like a pro, and I run, I jump on, and I get it the first time. And speed away and, clip in and do everything just like I should, or not clip in, but tighten down my shoes. And I've passed people that way. So you can really be fast either way. I prefer having my shoes clipped in and doing that. And if you practice that, you can be a little bit faster. Hmm. The reason why you want to do that too is if you want to be with a group and get some legal draft. But if you're in the middle and there's no legal draft, it's not a huge deal. So maybe... doing those, getting those, especially on an Ironman. So I'm guessing you're going to be somewhere in the, yeah, you won't be at the beginning of the race if you're 540. Mm-hmm. Putting on the, I would do the road shoes, obviously.
Yeah.
It'd be a little bit faster, I think.
Yep. I've never seen wind tunnel data on Giro's shoes, but they have some laced shoes that I saw a lot of people at Kona last year. And this is actually something that Justin Rossi, local now triathlete, used to be roadie guy. He does this as well. They're little laces that are elastic, and he puts them into the shoes, and then they cut the tongue out of those shoes. So once again, this will probably almost certainly void your warranty, but that's like a really popular triathlete thing that I've seen where they'll take those Giros and they're the Empires. Those are the shoes that they use. Like the SLX, I think, is the really light and more minimal one, but they'll take the Giro Empire and they'll cut the tongue out and they'll put those stretchy laces. I'm not sure which brand they are, so I apologize for that, but they'll put laces in there that provide like a lot of, elastication. So then you can actually keep the shoe on. So that's a common thing.
So in that effect, you get like a slip-on shoe that triathletes would do for running, mm-hmm. but because you're not sprinting, it's fine because you don't need that like extreme tension on the upstroke. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And the one thing also is somebody I saw on Slow Twitch pointed out the fact that like, well, with these, you have to put your finger down into the heel to put them onto your, onto your foot. And that's a bother. But if you have a Velcro shoe or anything else, you have to put your hand down there to put that strap on anyway. And in this case, you don't have any straps, any BOA dials, anything like that. So it's probably six half dozen, and then you're getting a more efficient shoe. I don't know how aero that shoe is though, because that's the one thing about aerodynamics. It can look like a missile, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's more aero. It's always tricky.
Another data point, and this is sad, Simon Whitfield, Trainer Road user, mm-hmm. he was a Olympic gold medalist. He came back to the Olympics and he crashed out trying to put his feet, he was clipped in and he kind of swerved. And I think he clips the back of somebody's wheel, but you can see a video of it. And I was hoping he was going to win that year. And he, the Olympics were over for him. Mm-hmm. So there's that to deal with too. So maybe if you're doing something like, especially Kona, where you start on that climb, I would rather be clipped in. If it's a really big race where...
Yeah, that's another consideration.
Yeah, mm-hmm. What's the benefit? And on the flip side, it's pros and cons. If you do run in the cleats and your cleat breaks, your race is also over unless you want to pedal, yeah. Just on your...
112 miles with one leg.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can push down, but it's just not going to be very fun. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, I actually remember somebody last year trying to... So at Kona specifically, you start out and it's a steep little kick when you start out. It's probably like a 7-8% little climb that you do.
And it's a windy little approach getting to it.
Too. Yep.
And there's a lot of people, a ton of people.
And sometimes it bottlenecks and it looks like mm-hmm. a Grand Fondo for a bit. It's kind of scary. And I remember actually seeing somebody last year, they couldn't shift their, which was really common. We saw so many people being in like the big ring and the smallest cog. Mm-hmm. They couldn't shift down in time. You're putting out all this stress and you have your feet on top of your shoes. You're sliding around. And I saw people have to get off and then walk their bike up that climb because they weren't getting in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to consider with this. But I guess practice is number one. If you're going to be slipping into your shoes like that, make sure you practice this.
On that race, what I would do is I would be clipped in ahead. So I'd have the shoes clipped in. I'd be in the little ring.
Yep.
And I would just spin up that hill nice and light with a high cadence. So there's no mm-hmm. extra strong torque. Then once you get up there, then get in.
Yep.
It's a long day.
Yeah.
Just don't worry about it. Don't
breathe easy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for submitting your questions. You can do so once again at trainerroad.com/podcast, and we'll go through more of them next week. We'll comb through them all, we promise, and then we will put them into this feed. Thanks everybody. Talk to you all soon.
Thanks everybody.
Bye-bye.